Hi, Michael.
Hi, Ian.
See, now that was a delayed response. Cool. So, welcome to the Futile Podcast. Tonight, we have Ian and...
Michael.
And we are going to talk about the John Hughes classic from 1985, The Breakfast Club. Now, this is one of your faves, right?
It is.
Okay, well, I don't know if we need to set it up too much. I think most people probably are aware of it. It's sort of a coming of age. Is it really a coming of age? That's usually more like an individual character study. It's kind of like an, maybe it's like an ensemble coming of age story. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd classify it as a coming of age, but it is, I guess it would be lumped in with that genre because they're high school students, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. So what do you like about it so much? Then we'll just start there. We'll start unraveling all kinds of things. Because I think there's a lot here to talk about. And like I said, when we were talking off pod, sort of setting this up, I think this is one movie that, I mean, it probably has been in certain ways and forms, but like could stand to have, certainly in this day and age, could stand for a remake or even a sequel in a weird way, to kind of get more into the, a greater variety and diversity of types of high school students, maybe.
Yeah. What do I like about it? I guess a big thing for me is there's a lot of depth in there. There's a lot of insight, because I think when you look at it on the surface, it seems kind of basic and stereotypical. There are five stereotypes that are thrown in a room together, but I think there's a lot of depth and meaning that is taken out of it once you get past the stereotypes of the characters. And I would probably say it is the only high school movie that remotely comes close to reflecting my high school experience. So there's a connection with me there as far as that's concerned. Every other high school movie I watch just doesn't come close to really reflecting what I feel like high school was actually like.
Okay. Yeah. No, I mean, so that's interesting. There's an authenticity to you about it. I mean, so you went to high school in Washington, right?
And California.
Oh, and California. Right. You split the difference. So that's interesting then. So would you say, I mean, I don't know your experience, but would you say that they're two fairly different places that you went to high school?
Yeah, I technically went to four different schools in high school.
Oh, wow.
And the first one was a private school. The second one was like a junior high. Then I went to high school. Those were both, that junior high and high school were both in California. And then I finished my 2 years out in Washington. And I would say they're all fairly different. I would almost say that my experience in the California schools was much more where you saw these stereotypes come alive. There are definitely those kinds of stereotypes in Washington, but it was a much smaller school, so it was much harder to be quite so exclusive as far as the popular girl and the jock and that kind of thing. They were still there, but the popular girl was the girl that I was best friends with in, you know, kindergarten or something, so she couldn't, you know, straight out ignore me or whatever. As opposed to California, where I didn't have that background, so I was very much just kind of the wallflower no one paid attention to. Did notice more that popular girl, jock, nerd, criminal sort of vibe going on.
Okay. Yeah, so that's interesting. I mean, so your experience and your assessment of the movie is kind of based on having, I think, greater than normal sense of variety in terms of your high school experience. So you got to see like the small school where everyone, there's kind of a greater accountability and connectivity between people. So like you said, you can still have elements of the stereotype, but they can't be so completely separated and segregated because there's just not enough people for it to be like a whole clique of the popular girls. It's like there's the popular girl, but like then there's just, you know, only 20 of these people in this class.
Right, so. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I get that sense too, having gone to, you know, living in a rural area and having, you know, my high school experience was kind of a similar way about that, where, you know, yes, there are these groups, but you can kind of not necessarily transcend them, but kind of they don't really, you know, they're not all encompassing, which I would imagine would definitely be the case in probably a larger place that's, I don't know. I mean, something like what the Breakfast Club is, where it's the typical, what is it, that John Hughes usually uses some kind of a, like, affluent suburbia of Chicago, white middle class, upper middle class kind of, or whatever, you know, the Home Alone house, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that being said, of course, I don't see myself reflected in any of the characters. I don't see myself as any of those stereotypes, which I'm sure no one really does. I think there are elements of each character that I can take home and be like, yeah, that was me in high school. More so like, you know, the nerd and the weird girl and whatnot. But like, I definitely wasn't really in any of those stereotypes like solidly in high school. So it's kind of a weird thing to say, yes, I recognize all these stereotypes. I didn't like, and I sort of identify with all these stereotypes, but I wasn't necessarily represented in the film.
Right. Well, and I think that's a good thing too. I mean, I think people have maybe gotten more wound up about this recently. I'm not necessarily recently, but this idea of being able to like see yourself in a movie as opposed to see a story about characters that are authentic, you know, I mean, like I just watched, not to get too tangential or whatever, but I just rewatched Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing last night. And there's all kinds of great characters in that. But I mean, like, you know, I'm a white boy from rural Northern California. I really have no experience with what it's like in that part of Brooklyn, New York, or any of those characters or any of those people. But then they could say something that I could laugh about. And that's because, like, I understand humanity enough to, like, there's those commonalities and those things there that I think is really what you get at when you're talking about like authentic characters, you know, that then develop or even just in the case of some movies, just kind of have a day in their life and things happen. And I agree with you that, yeah, Breakfast Club definitely, I mean, it doesn't, I don't think it, I mean, that is, some people will criticize it for saying, oh yeah, they're just such stereotypes, but it's like, if you actually sit and watch the movie and you don't even have to get more than like 10 minutes into it, you realize that it's not that that's the point, but that they're not like hanging a lampshade on it either. Like the idea is that you go into it getting these groups and these people and how they interact or not. And then you see that there's more to all of them as they're forced to have a conversation. I mean, you could do a similar type of story with just having five people get stuck in an elevator together in a hospital or something. Right. I mean, it'd be a similar kind of character study about groups of people and things. I mean, that's why I say I think that the idea of a remake, even though it's probably been done in a lot of other ways, could be very, there could be a lot there because there's certainly a lot more now with, you know, different, I mean, the story doesn't have, it doesn't have anyone of color, you know, it doesn't have anyone of any kind of gender aspect, you know, it's all, you know, heterosexuals and everything. And so, I mean, and not to sound like, you know, pandering or any of that, but I mean, those kinds of things are more upfront now and more part of, could be a part for, you know, to be dealt with in a bigger story in the context of those kinds of things as stereotypes that get deconstructed and broken apart or, you know, arrive at the whole, hey, guess what? You think we're all these things, but screw you, you know, we're actually just people trying to get through a life. Let me see. I'm going to revisit my Letterboxd review because it was a little while ago since I last watched it. And I watched it early in the morning. You know me, I've always got weird times for certain movies. And for some reason, and I think this is an obvious one, The Breakfast Club to me seems like it's a movie to watch when you like wake up too early on a Saturday morning. Because it's about these characters being somewhere early on a Saturday morning. So maybe it just fits. Some movies are very much set in a given window of time or whatever, you know. So What did I say here? I want to read from myself, to quote myself. No. Some questionable character turns, but ultimately it makes for a reasonably, I said deep as well, 80s teen comedy. A modern remake might be interesting. Oh, I use the I word. Interesting. Well, I try to keep the reviews really quick. It's mainly just so I have it to reference later in my, you know, waning years. I'm like, oh, I watched that movie. Yeah, so I'm trying to think now what with my one real criticism of being questionable character turns. It might have to do with the kind of shoehorned romance of the bad boy slash criminal and the popular, like, rich girl. I don't know how much of that I felt was kind of really, like, I don't know, maybe it didn't need to be part of the story for me. Like, it kind of undermined other things. I mean, romance is weird like that, especially in the context of a movie. If it's not really about that as much, then it kind of starts to seem weird. I mean, obviously he challenged her, and she kind of gave back to him, so there is a sense that, like, that they were, you know, would probably have arrived at some kind of mutual understanding and or respect, possibly, but who's to say? I'm trying to remember that if all of the kind of things that got brought up were ultimately, not that they all needed to be resolved, but if maybe there was a greater honesty there too. Because doesn't Bender, okay, so just for anyone that doesn't remember the darn movie, so you've got the bad boy, that's Bender, who then they named the robot Futurama after. And you've got Emilio Estevez playing the jock, but he's not, like, really a meathead jock. Like, there's already, like, depth in his character. Like, he's kind of quiet. He's not, like, all, you know? I mean, he kind of postures a bit, mm-hmm. but generally only against the criminal guy, you know? And you've got Anthony Michael Hall, who's just sort of the nerd and kind of annoying, but, like, whatever, that's his thing. And like you said, you've got the weird girl that wears all black and has dandruff and is, like, an artist. And then you've got kind of the mm-hmm. pretty in pink Molly Ringwald character. Okay, so everyone is now remembered now, so we can talk about the characters without, like, getting everyone being like, what was what? Who was who? But yeah, I feel like, so Bender kind of challenges Molly Ringwald's character.
Claire.
What is her name? Do you remember her name? Is it Jane? Claire, right. Right, now I won't forget it, yeah. Because he repeats it all these times. He gets that snarl on his face like he's such a punk. Yeah, John Hughes probably didn't really know what punks were, but he probably thought that was like a real punk character when he wrote it. Yeah, he challenges her to see if, like, you know, will you talk to this guy on Monday? And I don't know how much of that got kind of resolved or left open to just the reality of, like, yeah, we're going to kind of go back into our little groups after this, but we've at least had a... experience
that
might give us a little more.
Brian brought that
depth.
Up. You know, will you talk to me in the hallway on Monday? And Claire was like, no.
Oh, right,
and Bender gives her shit, which it's interesting.
Yeah,
and that's part of the reason. I know John Hughes wanted to make a sequel, but he hated working with Judd Nelson so much that he didn't. But I'm glad. I don't think I want to know what happens to these characters on Monday. I think that's part of the magic of the film is that they had this day where they all connected and, who knows what happens on Monday. Like, are the popular kids better now and they're going to acknowledge Brian in the hallway? Probably not. There's probably not going to be a romance that comes out of this, like they imply at the end, you know, like, and I feel like if he had made a sequel, it probably would have made The Breakfast Club less believable if he had pushed some of these things like, oh yeah, they do get into a relationship or they do end up being buddies with these like nerdy kids or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, a direct sequel, like in like 1986, I would definitely agree would undermine a lot, but something like revisiting where these characters would be at now, almost like doing like a, what would be like a reboot remake, but like the way that they kind of cheat with remakes now where they acknowledge the original and they have all the characters there, like in the Star Wars movies or in, you know, where it's like, they're still there kicking around and then what are their kids doing? Or are these other kids doing, you know, maybe Judd Nelson's character, maybe Bender would actually be the janitor at the high school this time. And, I don't know. That's not necessarily all that important. either way. It could give it or take it. Like I said, it's enough of a solid kind of framework for a story. I mean, like, you could throw all kinds of other movies out there, you know, something like 12 Angry Men, you know, put people in a room and have them talk about stuff and have them get argumentative and have them laugh. And, you know, these are like you said, it's not really a coming of age story. It's more like a, it's hard to pin it down because it's, I mean, I called it a teen comedy just to kind of keep it simple. Because it's got the music and it's got the running around the halls and the zaniness of what an 80s movie and a teen comedy kind of can have. But I think it's got, you know, obviously it's got more going on there. I mean, so did you get the Criterion for it? Because they just released the Criterion recently, Criterion Collection version of The Breakfast Club.
I did. I got the Criterion Blu-ray. I'm moving up in the world.
What's that? Yeah, I know, right? How's that? How did that look? Did that look immaculate?
It looked great. Yeah, I have been holding off on blue for quite some time, as most people who know me know. But I still have my tube TV with my DVD player, but I have moved on to a flat screen with a blue in the living room for social gatherings. So it's getting pretty high tech up here.
Did the Criterion come with any nifty special features or anything that you kind of were able to explore that gave you a little more insight into, you know, the
gosh,
movie?
I never watched special features. Did you not know this about me?
That's
I never watched
that. That's just your
no,
policy?
I just don't.
Or that you're just
I'm just not,
you're
into just... it. I don't know. I think I've watched commentary once. On one movie, might've been Gladiator. I can't remember what movie it was, but, yeah, I just don't do special features. I think that a lot of times, I have this view that art is open to interpretation. And so I don't want to know the director's opinion on whatever they did, kind of a thing. I want to know my opinion and how I felt watching it. So I think that plays into the fact that I don't watch any special feature. Plus, I know a lot about this movie anyway, obviously, so I kind of was like, right. I don't know if it'll add anything. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time that I don't have, you know.
Right, exactly. It's like, would I rather watch another movie,
yeah,
or whatever? I mean, yeah, I rarely listen to any commentaries, and even movies I really love, I mean, like, there's a double-edged sword there, because you listen to you watch the movie and it was great and it was an amazing thing, and then you're like, I don't know that I want to listen to the commentary of Heat now, you know, like, I'd either have to do it fairly soon, like, after watching the movie, so that way it doesn't spoil the next watching of the movie, and I'm hearing Michael Mann talking over me,
well,
you know, when it,
that's...
or whatever, but, I mean, yeah, I think there are good and bad special features, but, yeah.
And that's the thing, too,
to...
is I usually just, when I, the one time I watched commentary... Well, I guess there are two times I've watched commentary, but the first time I did, I was like, I can't watch the movie. I just want to watch the movie. They bring the volume down so I can't hear what the actors are saying to talk over it, right. And I just didn't get the point. That was the Gladiator one, but the other one was actually, what was it? Howl's Moving Castle, and that was much more interesting because it was more about the technique of making an animated film and dubbing an animated film.
Exactly.
Like, if I'm going to learn something about, you know, the process of making the something and like something new is going to crop up, then that'll be interesting for me. It'll be like a class, I guess. But if it's just like, oh, improv'd this. Well, I know you improv'd this. I've read articles about it. You know, I don't know.
or it's literally just, yeah, I completely agree. I think that like, like I said, it's not necessarily even just the commentary, but it's the kind of special features. It's either if it's stuff about technique and artistry, I'm all for it. I'm down to see some of that stuff for some of the movies I really like. There's sometimes the commentary is just amusing. You know, if it's like Kurt Russell and John Carpenter talking to each other for the first time in 10 years, kind of catching up while they watch Big Trouble in Little China. Like that's kind of fun. It's its own kind of entertainment. But yeah, just like someone like Ridley Scott smoking a cigar, just kind of talking to you like you don't know anything about movies, you know, like this is for the Walmart purchaser that got it for, you know, it's like, so right here we did this dolly shot, and it's like, that means that you put the camera on the wheels and roll it. And I was interested in talking with you about it because you've got such, like your tastes are not, I won't say unusual because that's not true, but you generally tend to gravitate more towards, stuff that's older. And I don't mean like older, like 80s. I mean older, mm-hmm. like before either of us was born. I mean like pre 60s, 70s, stuff, a lot of foreign movies and things. You're much more of a, not to overuse the word that gets overused, but I think you're much more of an actual mm-hmm. like cinema file. And I'm like a movie watcher. Like that's how I would describe myself, you know, like I don't talk about cinema very often, you know, I mean, but and so it was interesting to me that it's like, oh, what's this kind of like teen comedy, you know, thing, but I know there's more going on in it. And I'm like, let's really pick your brain about what you get out of it. And
yeah.
So
I mean, it's definitely got its flaws for sure. It's definitely not a perfect movie, but there's so much that you can take away from it, even in just these ridiculous little one-liners, like screws fall out of the time, the world's an imperfect place, like how much truth is in that statement. And it's little thing thrown in there after he's just trying to get the door shut so they can have a little privacy, you know, like it's such a simple moment, but that line is just has a bunch of hidden meaning and truth behind it. And so I think it's those gems that we find in there, that moment when they're all sitting around talking and they're like, oh, we're going to turn into our parents, aren't we? You know, like there's these moments of connection between people that are from very different backgrounds. And it's things like that that really draw me to the movie. That's what makes it my favorite John Hughes movie. It's not just, you know, the goofy high school comedy. It's got a lot of depth to it, and I can really identify with it. So I guess it's really what it comes down to. Obviously, you know, like them all smoking pot and running around and breaking glass and stuff. There's a lot of inconsistencies, like him screaming in the faculty lounge.
Oh, yeah,
break the glass.
I mean, you kind of have to give it a you have to give it a pass for certain things. I think that, yeah, that was during the drug use. I mean, if they had really been more, and this isn't a John Hughes thing anyway, but I don't know, they could have done some more interesting visuals / camera. Like, they could have done some more interesting things with the environment and everything else, you know, with them being stoned. Not that, like, hey, you smoke a little grass and all of a sudden you're on acid trip town or anything. Maybe they should have taken acid instead. Maybe in the remake they'll take some different drug. They'll take bat.
They'll take
bath salts and eat each other's faces off or something. No. But yeah.
They'll chew on Tide Pods.
Yeah, right. Tide Pods. Oh, Jesus. Is it coming to? That brings up two kind of questions I have for you. Not just for you, but like, you know, just to kind of, you know, get us thinking about it and talking about it. But, well, one is more just, do you actually, so there's it's almost its own genre, but it's not. But like the John Hughes movies, I mean, he's written other things like Planes, Trains, and mm-hmm. Automobiles. I think he wrote that, and a few other just comedies mm-hmm. that weren't teen things or anything. But would you consider yourself a mm-hmm. fan of John Hughes, or is this kind of an outlier because it's got things like, you know, the Imperfect World line and more sort of like writing depth for the characters?
No, I do enjoy John Hughes movies. I do not like coming of age films. So I would say that John Hughes is the outlier at that. If you consider any of his movies coming of age films, I think they're far more tolerable than 90% of the ones out there. And I think that's because of his writing skill and his ability to keep it light and that kind of thing. Like I never really identify with coming of age films. So the fact that I'm able to connect more with his films, I guess, says something. But I would put this one in a class above the rest for sure, even though I do enjoy, you know, Pretty in Pink and 16 Candles and Weird Science, you know, all those are a lot of fun. But this is something kind of different, I feel like, from most of his stuff.
Yeah, yeah, it's got a lot less, it's less of the sex comedy angle. It's, yeah, it's more, I guess it's more, like you said, more real, more legit, more deep.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do you think about, and I think this is a thing that happens a lot in movies where, you know, characters are kind of at odds with each other, or there's a potential for conflict, and then there's always the kind of mellow down scene when they all, like, imbibe, you know, they smoke some marijuana, or they have a beer or whatever, and then it's like the uptight guy calms down. And I mean, in some cases it's done better than others, because in some cases I feel like it's like, well, the uptight guy's right half the time, and then the movie's just saying the uptight guy just needs to smoke some weed and chill, and the cool guy's gonna help him do it. And it's like, well, the cool guy's kind of a flake and an asshole. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes they don't get it right, you know? Like, in these, especially, like you said, in a lot of these coming-of-age movies or these teen comedies, it's like, hey, you know, mousy girl, let's make you hot, and then everyone will like you, and then you'll still learn the, like the got, people have to have a brain, but you know what I mean? Like, right. There's just these, like, there's these mixed and muddled messages about like, how people should grow up and behave and whatever else. And yeah. I mean, I don't know that I necessarily have a problem with, like I said, the use of the this kind of writer crutch that happens in a lot of these character stories, where it's like, now they use drugs and they're able to connect more profoundly or calm down and talk to each other. I mean, I don't know if it would be better if they didn't do that and they just kind of were able to do that without the drug, or if the drug kind of, like you said, is just a point at how, like you said, authenticity to how life really is. I mean, people go to parties almost 9 times out of 10, people go to parties and there's alcohol and people drink alcohol and it's a social lubricant and it, you know, helps some people calm down and mellow out and they can be less tense and they can have a conversation. And I mean, so I don't know. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get at is what do you think about that? What do you think about the use in this movie of drugs, and then just what that says about, like, whether or not people can actually arrive at growth, you know? I mean, like, there's kind of a falseness, right? You know, it's like the two people that are friends of friends at a party, and they both get drunk, and then they can talk about some band they like, and by the end of the party, they're both really drunk, and they think they love each other, you know, slap each other on the back and laughing, and then they might not ever see each other again, you know? Like, it's like, but like you said, in the context of something like The Breakfast Club, maybe that moment is what it's about. So maybe that moment when they all got stoned and they arrived at some understanding for each other will inform their characters as their lives go on. But the reality is that, hey, people don't really change all that much. They do kind of fit in some kind of a confined box that more often than not they put themselves in.
Yeah. I don't know. The pot sequence is interesting because they have the moment when they're all getting high. Andrew's running around like a crazy man and breaking glass, and Claire's talking about how popular she is and everything. But then there's the moment real connection comes after that, and I'm not sure if the implication is they're still high or they're coming off of it, or like what the deal is, because that whole sequence where they, you know, famously improvised, you know, why they were sent to detention, there's still a lot of tension. There's still Bender being an asshole to Claire and just ripping on her for being popular and whatever. So, like, you have that. I don't really feel like the pot is even used to as a social lubricant in it. It because what, even though, like, Andrew's opening up about why he's in there and Brian's opening up about why he's in there, then you have this tension between Claire and Allison. Nice. There's like a tension between them where they get into a fight. There's a tension between Claire and Bender where they get into a fight. And like, so there's still, they're not entirely socially lubricated in that scene. There's a tension and ups and downs and moments where they're not fighting and they're connecting, and then moments where they are fighting. So I'm not quite sure if there's even a point to the pot scenes other than you get to see Claire and Brian and Andrew kind of relax a little. And but even then it passes on quickly to the post pot scene, I guess.
I think that maybe that is the point then. I mean, you're right. You've made a good point there that, I mean, marijuana can last for longer than the context in this movie, but if, I mean, who knows, maybe it's a weak strain, mm-hmm. who knows, whatever. But it seems like, yeah, that like the high fun, everyone hanging out, being friendly, kind of sitting in a circle, rah-rah part happens. But then, like you said, then they're kind of coming off of it. And then it's like, oh, here, we're still sitting in a circle. Mm-hmm. We're still stuck here. And there is that kind of like, so maybe you're right. Maybe that does ground the reality more in the sense of like, okay, yeah, you're all at a party and now you wake up the next day and it's like, everyone's still there. And it's like, oh yeah, hi, remember. not in, and you know what? I think one thing that is in to the credit of this movie is that, because I was just thinking of like other big movies that are about like people go to parties and they get drunk or whatever, and then they yell at people and fight with their spouse and flip over tables and it gets real melodramatic, you know, and it's like mm-hmm. a play or something. And I'm like, and this movie has bits of that, but it manages to never, I feel like it manages to kind of skirt that edge and never quite feel too melodramatic in the performances mm-hmm. or in the content. Because maybe because it stays kind of, I don't know, like you said, grounded by the reality of the characters and of the situation that they're in or something.
Yeah, it does.
But
No, I was, yeah, it does manage to, because there are moments where you're like, okay, here comes the moment where Bender's going to yell about this, or, you know, here comes the moment when like this happens, but they always manage to get back out of it somehow. And I don't know if that,
right.
Yeah. I don't know if that's just, you know, you could be talking about trying to commit suicide with a flare gun, and then all of a sudden you're laughing because you tried to commit suicide with a flare gun. You know, like, it's just kind of, like, you know, laughing at funerals. I've done it. You know, it's one of those weird life right. things.
No. I mean, like, and for the record, like, I think laughing at a funeral is great. If it happens and you end up at my funeral, or, you know, like, if you hear that I'm dead, feel free to laugh. Go ahead. I will appreciate it. Know that the Ian gives you full approval to laugh. Okay, so that's two things you've kind of said just really quickly in passing that I was not necessarily aware of, because you know the movie better than I. One I want to say is that you're mentioning the kind of like jovial and then like tense and jovial. Yeah, that back and forth in there really does add like a realistic kind of tension element to the movie, because these characters are all not like just pals mm-hmm. palling around. And I just realized that, like, yeah, that kind of adds another little genre layer that's just thinly sort of scraped along the toast of the plot, you know, which is this like, oh, is Bender going to blow up at somebody again? Is this going to turn into somebody be crying in a second? I mean, like, it's kind of scary like that. And it is back and forth, which I think is kind of how certainly young people behave. I mean, adults behave that way too. Let's be honest. Most people don't grow up. And even if they do, like, you know, whatever. But so that's you're right. That's another good point about something that the movie brings that's great. But then you mentioned improvisation, and I wasn't aware of that. So maybe just kind of explain to me and any listeners, which might just be me when I edit it, how much of their individual when they finally, after the marijuana, and they sit down and they have their cry and tell their own little bits about things. How much of that is improvised?
I'm not sure how much of that whole scene is. I think I've read that most of it was improvised by them. Definitely Andrew confessing what he did, and I think Brian confessing. I think their confessions of what they did to get in were improvised. Beyond that, I'm not exactly sure, because part of me is has a hard time accepting that they could improvise the entire thing and it would be that good.
Right. Yeah. That's the thing that bugs me about it, is that it's also crucial to an aspect of the story, and to those is in a story that is so character driven that I feel like that's a pretty major thing. Like, if it's all, and now what I would probably say is, and the way improvisation has changed for comedy lately, you know, in the last 10 years or whatever, is probably when they use that term, they probably mean it in a much more strict, like, oh yeah, you know, he had the idea written down and we kind of just modified it on set or something. I bet it's much less than, like, say, a Judd Apatow movie where, hey, we just rolled the camera and let these guys just make stuff up on the fly or whatever, loosely based around whatever was going on in the plot. Because, like you said, that, you know, the Emilio Estevez's character, Andy's story and Brian's story both feel kind of like, yeah, you're not just going to make that up necessarily. I mean, maybe they studied their characters or really got into it, and maybe they did make up backstory for them and on their own. I don't know. Actors prepare, right?
Yeah, but they're all, except for Judd Nelson, they're all high school students. So part of me is like, there's no way high school students could come up with that. But yes, apparently that scene is improvised, but to what extent, I don't know. So that's entirely possible. Maybe he was like, okay, I want you to have bullied somebody, so just kind of go on that and tell us what way you would have bullied somebody and how it made you feel and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think his is probably the best, because his is this like weird, twisted aspect of like what makes somebody a bad person, you know? Like, you know, you're a good, you know, people start and they're kind of like, just want to make friends, they're little kids, you know, and no one's a bad little kid to begin with. I mean, there might be little fuckers running around, but, you know, whatever. But then, yeah, the idea that he felt he needed to be a certain kind of person, and then that made him, because of his father, and then that made him behave a certain way to another student, and then he thought, you know, he flipped it around in his head and, you know, thought about how that student's father would feel about what happened to him, and it turns into this whole like sins of the father eternal recurrence, you know, kind of vicious cycle thing. And that's kind of like a very insightful way as to where something in the way humans treat each other like kind of adds up to something in life. Like I said, that's probably that's definitely one of the deeper bits, is that part of Andy's confession. I remember Brian. I don't always remember Andy's every time. I think I remember Brian's because it's the most like sort of straightforward, but I wasn't sure. I think I forget.
Until he gets to the flare gun.
Yeah, I forget the flare gun part. And I always feel like I don't remember if it was that he brought the gun to threaten somebody else, or if he was like, I mean, you said suicide. Like, did they make that abundantly clear that he was just going to try to shoot himself? Like, at school, in front of everybody, like look at what you made me do,
he doesn't lay out a plan. Basically, right, just says, like, I had a gun, and it went off in my locker.
Yeah.
Because it was a flare gun. It's because he was like, I mean, they do make it abundantly clear that he's going to kill him, so he wasn't going to, like, kill other people. But why he's bringing it to school, I don't know.
Right, it was the pressure from getting everything right or whatever. That was the thing.
Getting an F in his wood shop class.
Shop class.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's another good point. Yeah, the wood shop, oh, you think it's easy, yeah, but it's like, no, it's actually making stuff. It's not like it's... Yeah, none of these things. No, in that sense, like, it does do a little bit of a good job of kind of breaking down the kind of class pretenses of things, you know, like, oh, hey, only blue collar idiots take shop. It's like, no, you actually have to know about stuff to make things. Like, you pretty much, if you're going to be good at anything in life, even if it seems like an idiotic thing, even if you're a dumb rock star, you still have to, like, know music on some level, or at least understand things about music.
Yeah.
Did they even get into anything about Bender? Like, I think it's just like that's just his thing. He just gets, you know, in trouble.
Well, he pulled the fire alarm for this particular one, but then the next 2 months, it's that whole interaction with him and the
principal who raised Barry Manilow's closet.
Not the principal. I can't remember what he is, but yeah. And then Claire skipped class to go shopping, and then Allison didn't do anything. She just was bored, so she showed up.
Yeah, but then her parents brought. Still, I mean, their parents all dropped them off, so, except for Bender. For Bender. And so there's something strange about, like, I think with Allison's, you get a couple of it's like the Joker, you know? Like, you don't know the origin story. She'll tell you something, but then it will be like, that's not true. And then she'll tell you something else later. Or, you know, she says it was from having an illicit affair with the art teacher or something like that. Or that she's doing that. Yeah, that's not why she would be in detention, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Assistant Principal Vernon.
And that
interaction with Bender, and just in general, the assistant principal and his interaction and his conversation with the janitor, I think is another thing that they bring to the table, because they don't just have to make the guy like the man, like he's just bad. They do add some kind of they give him some kind of what the right word is, but we keep saying depth, and I don't think that's necessarily, I mean, that's right, but there's something else to it. It's not super deep either, but it's just like, it's not even pathos. It's just that there's an understanding there for that character. Mm-hmm. You know, he talks about, you know, these kids used to be, you know, it's the whole like old people thing. As you get older, you know, you think, God, these kids are crazy. I mean, these things that they do and that they say and the behavior that they have. And it's like, yeah, well, you know, your parents used to say that too. Well, you know?
It's an interesting, too, because that whole interaction with the janitor and then him being like, you know, they get worse every year. And then the janitor saying, the kids haven't changed, you have. Sort of also brings an element of, the asshole... Vernon, you mess with the bull, you get the horns. Like, that's not the only side of it. The side of it was, you know, he started this thing and it was one way when he started, and now it's different because he's changed and he doesn't enjoy it anymore. So you get like a little bit more depth. Plus the whole interaction between him and Bender in the closet is really interesting to me. Because it's like, he's changed his role. His role's always been the same to Bender. And then when he gets him in the closet, he changes the role and is like, just hit me, go ahead and hit me, and let's fight right here, right now. And that freaks Bender out because the assistant principal or whatever he is stepping outside of what is accepted. Like, they each have their role. Bender has his role as the school asshole, and this guy has the role of, I'm just going to constantly keep you down and in school and doing this thing. And this guy steps out of it and into Bender's world of violence. And it freaks Bender out, which is a really interesting dynamic, I think, that isn't really... You don't really hear about that too much.
Right. Yeah, that's another good scene that's more in the, obviously a fairly, you know, it's a dramatic scene. It's not, there's nothing all that funny about it. I mean, you've got a lot going on there because you do have the principal being driven to the point of just frustration, you know, and you can see his side, you know. Yeah, he's changed, but the kids have changed too. That's how culture works. That's how things go. I mean, they didn't have metal detectors in schools in 1950, blah, 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 whatever. You know, things are bad, things are good, it's not all of one thing, or it's not all of one person's fault or anything really. But when he does kind of step into that, like that dark place where he's like, yeah, I want you to do this, you know, come on. And you see the side of like his own kind of anger and frustration and violence. And then the fact that he is this person in a position of power, and that's like the way that he really truly does kind of in a way, I think it's only one of the first times, maybe for me, probably the only time in the movie when I really do feel kind of bad for Bender. Like, I mean, because you've heard about, at this point, I think you've heard about, like, the abuse he's had from his father, which is kind of, like, easy, like, whatever. And the asshole mean kid is going to be, you know, yeah, he went through some shit with his folks. You know, his dad put cigarette butts out on him and stuff. And now you have this other adult character who's essentially antagonizing him in a way that's, like, going to trigger all kinds of things in him. It's going to trigger a certain kind of rage. Well, like, you know, like it's a surrogate dad, you know? That's why he probably fights with him in the first place. He's acting out against this authority, not kind of really knowing what the measure of the appropriate way to do that is, because when he was a kid, he, you know, was abused. And so, yeah, I think that's the first time that they, and maybe kind of the only time where they really ground some real pathos, not maybe not pathos, but, you know, something like that for Bender's character.
Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting to me. Bender's character feels the most authentic and is the most recognizable stereotype from my high school experience, which I find really fascinating. To me, he makes it because I knew so many guys like that, and everything that he does, harassing Claire, and pushing buttons the way that he does, his reactions to Andrew, to, like, any sort of aggression, any sort of pushback, is very, very authentic to me, which, is really interesting. And, he's sort of, I don't want to say, like, without him, it wouldn't be the same movie, but without him, it wouldn't be the same movie, you know, like,
well, no, absolutely. Yeah.
I know they wanted, what's his name? John Cusack to play that character. And I can't even, like, I'm sure he would have been fine, but, there's something that Judd Nelson brings to it that just is really, really authentic. And, that is every other character is very much, it's kind of like a cookie cutter stereotype. And when I see his character, I'm like, no, I knew so many kids like this. Every reaction he has is something that I saw in high school.
Yeah, that's definitely, I think I agree with you that, I mean, his character motivates most of the things that happen. He pulls the screw out of the door. He engages with the assistant principal. He brings the marijuana into the situation. He's the only, I mean, the rest of them probably would have been fine to just not talk to each other the whole movie if he hadn't started kind of tweaking things and adjusting things and forcing these interactions on people. So he's the disruptive element that creates, that motivates the storyline. And yeah, without that character, you wouldn't have any of that. So it is the most important. I think he is the most important character in the story, and he's, like, definitely got the most going on. I think the fact that he's older probably informs, you know, it just means he's probably a better actor at that point. You know, he's got more life experience that he can be drawing from. I mean, the fact that he was difficult with John Hughes, I don't know what that amounts to. Maybe Hughes wanted it to be more of, I mean, he wanted John Cusack at the time. I mean, John Cusack had done things like Better Off Dead and things that I think are hilarious and I enjoy quite a bit. But that kind of John Cusack 80s comedy character, even if he was trying to stretch it and going outside of his range, I just don't know how much I would have been able to buy it. It would have been a different character.
Very different,
yeah. Even if he was saying almost the same lines, it just, there would have, I mean, it's easier to kind of find a sympathy in the John Cusack type of character, I think. It's just the way he delivers things that he kind of, his little bag of tricks kind of works better there. And, I mean, Judd Nelson is just very abrasive. I think he's abrasive in most things that I've seen him in. He hasn't been in a lot of stuff, but yeah, he's got that kind of perpetual snarl.
Yeah, it's interesting.
I don't think
you go back and forth between being like, God, this guy is just pushing all the buttons and really can't stand him, and then feeling sorry for him because, you know, his home life isn't great, so he's taking it out on everyone around him and stuff. And it's that, to me, that sort of back and forth with the character where you're like, I really don't know how to feel about this guy. He's such an asshole, and you know he's probably going to turn into his dad. You know, like, he's just going down this this downward spiral kind of thing is very, like, real. It's very real. Like, people are very hardly ever one thing or the other, you know. So, he's great.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so it's just, I mean, the movie, I think it starts mm-hmm. with Brian's voiceover, which I don't know how I feel about that. That fact that, I mean, not that it's a spoiler on the rest of the story, though it kind of is. I mean, like, that he's already kind of writing this thing to kind of convey something about all these characters as if they've already arrived at a consensus. Maybe, it's a movie. We know that they're going to all get along at the end or that they're going to arrive at something at the end. I don't know, whatever. But yeah, I mean, like you said, you don't really know how to feel about Bender. I mean, by the end, I think you understand him more as a character. And so, I mean, it's different. I mean, like, for, I think the kind of interactions, like, you know, not to get into this too much, but like, you're a woman, I'm a man, you know, your high school experience is inevitably going to be different than mine because of a lot of things, but also just, you know, the kinds of character, like the way that you would deal with someone like a Bender versus the way that I would deal with them might be fairly similar in a lot of respects, but the fact that you're a woman and the fact that I'm a man, there's kind of a difference there. Like, you know, like how a guy deals with another guy that's an asshole can sometimes be one of two things, you know, or a couple of things. You know, it can either be very confrontational, like the way Brian does initially.
Andrew.
Or there could be kind of a like, Andrew, not Brian. Or it can be kind of, you know, you could be moot like Brian or Meek. Or you can kind of, I don't know, try to, like, my approach with people generally is to kind of, like, if they're being abrasive, is to kind of maybe be abrasive back, but just enough to get to a point where, like, I don't know. I recently rewatched Patton, the George D. Scott war movie. And at the end, you know, they're celebrating, you know, the translator with the Russian guy. And he's like, the general would ask you to share a drink with him. And Patton's like, you tell him I won't share no son of a bitch in Russian drink, you know, blah, blah, blah. And tell him word for word. And then the guy does it. And then the translator turns back around. He's like, the general says that you're a son of a bitch too. And then he kind of laughs and he says, I'll drink to that. And then they drink, you know, like one asshole to another. And I don't know if that's necessarily where everyone has arrived with Bender at the end, is that they kind of like, yeah, you're an asshole, but shrug, you're an asshole. Like every third thing you're going to say is going to be kind of aggravating, but then every third thing you're going to say is going to be kind of funny and true. And then, you know, you might actually have, you know, a humanity too. That So it's tough, you know, like you said, when you look at the people in the world and the people you choose to befriend or to tolerate or to completely write off. There's a lot going on there. And I think that that's why we're like a remake could be good, you know, getting into these things beyond just the identifiable straw man elements of what a kind of character is, you know, like a NASCAR fan or a, you know, whatever, you know, I mean, people get a little too comfortable sometimes with stereotypes of people that they think they don't like or don't want to like. And, I don't know. We'll see. I mean, it's almost like at this point it starts to feel like are people just trying to get to the point where they can compartmentalize enough people that they can completely write them off and remove them from society somehow? Is that the dream? Or is the dream to transform them into all becoming woke in the appropriate woke way that you dream is the right way to do it? Or, I mean, like I said, you could get into a lot of that stuff in a remake of Breakfast Club, maybe, and really maybe it would be good or maybe it would get really... overwrought. I don't know.
Yeah, it could definitely. I think it's one of the few movies that could definitely stand a remake. I generally don't like remakes, but this is one that's so, the themes are so kind of timeless. Everyone goes through high school and everyone has these kinds of issues that it's definitely one that could be, especially in this more modern era, a more diverse cast, like you said, gender fluidity, and even like the Me Too era kind of thing, some of the shit Bender gets away with in this movie wouldn't fly today, hopefully. Although that is part of why, I mean, even though, yes, the things he does in it are problematic, that is part of the high school experience that I, because I went to high school before the Me Too movement. So, you know, I went to high school when this was accepted. So that's part of what makes it identifiable for me, but it would be good to kind of do one for the generation that is more woke, I guess you could say, and has, each generation has their own issues to kind of battle with. And so I think it's one that can definitely could do a remake every generation and talk about the issues that everyone struggles with, no matter what, you know, gender they identify with or what, you know, whatever.
Right, and I think that that's still ultimately, like, very crucial to the theme, is that this idea of, regardless of the generations, you know, at the end of the day, there are some commonalities about how people should treat each other and everything else. And I think that's, like you said, it is a timeless thing. It probably, in some way or form, has been either remade or was a remake itself of, like I said, all kinds of different, you know, 12 Angry Men, those kinds of things. Those put a bunch of people in a room and then let them suss this out. Mm-hmm. Thing. I mean, no,
the
I didn't.
Have
I
you
mean,
seen that?
Big surprise there, right?
It is.
Oh, right. That's
the
true.
Breakfast
that's
Club
a good point.
In,
yeah,
set
it's
in
the
a game.
that's a good point. Yeah, and then they do switch them all around, right? Like that, the nerd guy ends up in the body of the Rock, and then that the hot girl ends up in Jack Black's body, or something like that. And yeah, I saw the trailer and was like, okay, I don't really, and I just wasn't, I don't know. Like you said, there's only so much time, and that's why it's tough to revisit movies too sometimes, though I've been doing more of that recently too. Like, don't even get me started on shows and stuff. Oh my gosh. I start to whittle things down and just let things go. Cool. Well, I mean, just to kind of put a pin in the Breakfast Club, I mean, unless there's anything else you wanted to address, any notes you want to reference or things you feel like are lingering about your criticism of it or anything?
I don't think so.
Well, I mean, for me, I mean, on my Letterboxd rating, and I still feel like this is a solid 3.5 out of 5. You know, it's a above average good. Like you said, there are problematic elements and other things that aren't necessarily, you know, perfect about it, but it's a definitely well above average, you know, and that's where I land with it as a star rating.
Mm. I'd probably give it a 4 out of 5. I definitely have, it's a sentimental view for me. I maybe rate it a bit higher because I'm so fond of it, but I think in general, it's a really solid movie. It's a great, the writing is great. There's a lot of timeless themes in it. So, and it's highly rewatchable, which is important to me. So yeah, I give it a 4 out of 5.
Yeah. Now the rewatchability factor is good. I mean, absolutely. Cool. Well, this was fun having a chat. I don't know if there's anything else you want to talk about on the podcast. I remember Facebook mentioned other things to potentially talk about, other movies and things, but maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, at some point we'll have to do
that was the big thing, right? Yeah, because Manhunter, and then Manhunter. And had you not seen Heat, or you just hadn't seen it in a while at all?
I haven't seen
Heat.
Gosh. Yeah, or Thief, but I bought Thief. And
yeah, I've got Thief, too. I've seen it, but I haven't watched it yet. I'm going to revisit Thief and Heat. Okay, well, when I do, I'll let you know that I have done it, and then when you do the same, and then at some point we'll arrive at some time when it makes sense to talk about this. I'll be interested do you like kind of, I mean, you definitely, I know you like film noir, but this is definitely firmly seated in the, well, I mean, you saw Manhunter, and you liked Manhunter, right?
Yeah, I loved Manhunter. So.
Then I think I don't remember Thief as much as Manhunter, because I saw Manhunter more recently. I mean, but they both just, like, yeah, they're the epitome to me of, like, good neo-noir in the sense that, like, it's crime story stuff, but it's got modern stuff going on. It's very much of its age. I mean, Manhunter was so drenched in 80s, and Michael Mann is a very stylish director, but all in good ways. Like, I mean, I think I still, like, when I watched Manhunter the first time, I think I watched it super late slash early, you know, where it's like, oh, it started at 2 a.m. or something, or 3 o'clock in the morning. And it kind of dragged for me in places. I mean, it took me a while as I got older myself to become less of like the little kid that identifies with like, there's got to be like a super awesome proactive protagonist in my story. Because like the Will Graham character is fairly damaged. And now I love stuff like that. I think I've gotten older and become more damaged and more meek and whatever else, and less like heroic, like I'm going to go out and live the world. It's like, no, the world is a terrible place. I'm going to just go sit on the beach for, I just want to sit on the beach and I don't want to go back out into it. But yeah. Just like the really wide shot of him when he has the experience with Lecter, it might've been the first time, and he's running like that zigzag of those stairs. I mean, again, it's all white and stuff. I'm like, not only is like that whole set design and everything super 80s with the music. And I mean, like I bought the soundtrack after I watched it last time. I was like, there's some good stuff. Man definitely is pretty unapologetic about some of his 80s stylism stuff. And
that's what makes it, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it elevates it in a lot of ways beyond
You could not make that movie in any other decade.
Right. Well, I mean, they did. They remade it with... they did a kind of bland version of it, which was the one that Ed Norton ghost-directed via... What's his name? Brett Ratner, the Red Dragon. And Ed Norton's a good actor.
Yeah, but that's a totally... Yeah. It's a totally different movie, essentially, because it was not made in the 80s by Michael Mann. Like, it's just so unique.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. I mean, I think... Anyway, so I'll be interested what you get out of Thief and Heat is a long one. It's a 3-hour epic. It's a started early on a Sunday or started early on a Saturday. Not early, but you know, at like 6 o'clock or something. Maybe take a break. Not like a break, but like, you know, don't force yourself to watch it in one without pausing it a couple times.
Yeah.